Live from Radio Monterey on California's beautiful Central Coast, this is the Ringside Boxing Show. I'm your host, Dennis Taylor, inviting you to join me and my expert analysts, Travis Hartman, Rizwan Zahid, and John J. Responte, today and every Sunday at ringsideboxingshow.com for the hottest, sweatiest boxing show on the West Coast. And don't forget to download TuneIn, our free app, so you can listen to us every Sunday on your smartphone. And now, from Studio 1A, it's the Ringside Boxing Show.
Hey, welcome to the Ringside Boxing Show. We're coming to you live from Monterey, California, streaming worldwide right now at RadioMonterey.com. We got a great hour planned. Today's featured guest is a Hall of Fame referee who was the third man in the ring of some of the biggest fights of our generation, including Pernell Whitaker, Julio Cesar Chavez, Holyfield Beau, Mosley De La Hoya, Pacquiao Marquez. This guy ref close to 200 world title fights and nearly 900 fights in a career that spanned from 1978 to 2012. Wow. And now he's an ESPN analyst. He's fair, but he's firm, so stay tuned for what I guarantee will be a fascinating conversation today with the great Joe Cortez on the Ringside Boxing Show. First, let's check in with our expert analyst. Travis Hartman's a professional boxer, boxing trainer from Osborne, Missouri. He's now living and training West Palm Beach, Florida. Rizwan Zahid's a boxing journalist from Toronto. And John J. Responte is chief lead writer for MaxBoxing.com and DoghouseBoxing.com. And we got John J. Responte with us right now and hoping to connect with Travis and Rizwan soon. John, you were at the Andre Ward fight last night. What was the atmosphere like, man?
There was 8 fights in total, so it was a long card. Some good fight, some good fights. But everybody was waiting for Andre Ward because obviously there's some questions because he hadn't fought very much, and the crowd was very into it. A good crowd. They had actually had a fight going on during. Our former guest, previous guest from a few weeks ago, Jojo Diaz, was fighting, and then there was another fight going on in the crowd, and it was actually a little bit of a better fight. I mean, if you're
really?
Like, team man tough man contest, they're going toe-to-toe. So it had a little bit of everything, a lot of music, some fights in the crowd, but mostly the crowd was good, and then the Andre Ward fight was a good fight, and it was a competitive fight for a couple of rounds, and then like he's prone to do, Andre Ward, he just finds his rhythm, and I think rust was getting him a little bit in the beginning. The first 2 rounds, Dennis, was very intriguing because did you see the fight?
You bet. Let me give you my take on this thing.
Sure, go right ahead.
I need to have you talk me off the ledge again, once again,
okay,
on this Easter Sunday, okay?
All right, sure.
Andre Ward, to me, is absolutely amazing in his technical efficiency. He's something a true boxing aficionado or Andre Ward's mother can appreciate, and I certainly do, and the HBO TV crew absolutely gushed about him for 12 rounds. Mm-hmm. But you know what? I just don't see how this guy becomes a TV attraction with the general fight public. He's going to be a Hall of Famer. I have no doubt about that. But he's perfectly content to be dull as dirt as long as he wins. He's an all-time great that nobody is going to think about or talk about 20 years from now. I think, why should they? Ward and Virgil Hunter are so deeply in love with their artistry, and I can't blame them for it, but they absolutely refuse to let a fight break out. That's great strategy. It's a way to stay healthy, and Ward is the best I've ever seen at it, or one of them. But it's not what fight fans are interested in watching. So my take is, sorry, Andre, sorry, HBO, sorry, Max Kellerman, but that's where the rubber hits the road in boxing entertainment. Yeah, I think fans are going to tune in to watch him fight Sergey Kovalev, and I certainly am going to be one of them. But Kovalev is going to be the main attraction in that fight for most boxing fans, I think. And, John, I think we can absolutely expect that Ward's game plan against Kovalev is going to be nonviolent neutralization, because that's what Andre Ward does. So, like I said, there's my Easter Sunday rant. Talk me off the ledge. You were at Oracle. You spent lots of time with Andre and also Virgil Hunter. Where am I wrong?
Well, you're not really wrong. It's just, I think that Andre Ward is like a great, like you said, he's a great artist. He's a great painter. I mean, 20 or 30 years from now, people will probably be revering his ability. But I've come to the point where I just respect the fact that he's not going to do what some people want him to do. He's going to do what he's going to do. And he is very content with that. And we just have to accept that, too, I think, and enjoy him, because I don't think his career will go, you know, 2 or 3 years more tops, because he's going to fight as long as he wants, and then he's going to get out of there. Now, the question about when a fight will break out against Golov, because Golov will really push him when they fight. Now, what I was noticing, and I'm sure the HBO team was gushing about, I would think, because we were just going, wow. His defense, we all know that, is so on target. And speaking of being on target, Barrera was not on target. He could not barely touch him with that right hand. Andre was real sharp. And, I can't really disagree with you much that, but being a boxing aficionado, boxing historian, it has never bothered me just because he's brilliant. And brilliant deserves all the respect in the world. He does it his way, and that's something you have to respect. Rocky Marciano is the most exciting heavyweight to a lot of people, but he did it his way, too. He just was blood and guts. Andre Ward is saying, I'm going to hit you, but you're not going to hit me. And it is a unique, in a way, because boxing is so brutal, style of doing it. But, I mean, what I noticed yesterday is people like Travis have spoken about how boxers are the most competitive people in the world, and every time Sullivan Barrera would manage to touch Andre Ward, which wasn't very often, even in the classic world, Andre would fire back, boom, like, no, you're annoying me, you just touched me with that. And so, you know, I hope that, I don't know, he's never going to get the full-fledged credit that he deserves, I think, but he, after two rounds where the guy was a little bigger, maybe a little stronger, he was phenomenal. So, like I said, I can't really disagree with very much you say, Dennis, but I hope maybe someday there will be a universal applause for a lot of people will be applauding, not just people that love boxing history and all that and appreciate the talent. We'll go, wow, that guy really was something. And I really believe that'll happen. It's just right now?
Yeah.
No. But the fight with Kovalev, Dennis, it's going to be a barn burner, I'm telling you.
Man, I hope so. Travis and Rizwan are both with us now. Travis, you're a professional boxer. Give us your take on the artistry of Andre Ward and whether when he fights Kovalev, is this going to be a fascinating fight or business as usual for Andre Ward?
Well, Dennis, I want to first give a pre-statement here that says, I think that you are the nicest person in the world before I say this. But I think that you are so far off on Andre Ward. And I say this because of this. Andre Ward, if I'm not wrong, guys, didn't Bob Arum say this to Floyd Mayweather? You will never be a fan attraction. Your fighting style is never going to be big. And then what does Floyd Mayweather do? Floyd Mayweather goes and becomes one of the richest professional boxers of all time, selling the most pay-per-view sales of all time. And his style was thought to be very boring, which I agree that to the average fan, Andre Ward is that way. But what's going to separate Andre Ward is he doesn't care who he fights. He will fight anybody. He's going up in weight to fight Sergey Kovalev. And you're right, they will market Kovalev because Kovalev is the mean, the Russian, the overseas guy who knocks people out. But Andre Ward is the guy who's going to last in this game. Andre Ward is the guy who's just smart, intelligent. I think he's going to be a major star. It's going to take him longer, but I think he is, and I think he already is, guys. Andre Ward, honestly, right now, is my current favorite fighter of all time right now. He genuinely is. I just like everything about the guy. I think he's going to be a huge star. I think the public is going to start to catch on because we always used to say that Manny Pacquiao is the nicest guy in the world. And nobody thought nice guys sell, but Manny Pacquiao is the nicest guy in the world. He's so polite and everything. So nice guys can sell. And I think Andre Ward is right there. I think he can sell. I think he's talented. I think he's a special fighter. I do agree with you when you say that. You think he's going to be a Hall of Famer. I think absolutely he'll be a Hall of Famer. But I think he is going to catch on because all he has to do is beat a couple guys that everybody thinks is untouchable. Everybody thinks Sergey Kovalev is untouchable. If Andre Ward beats him, that's going to be exciting. Everybody thinks Triple G is untouchable. Andre Ward beats him. People are going to think that's exciting. Maybe not necessarily the fight, but the build-up to those fights is going to be exciting. He's going to sell. He's going to be a major star, and I think he's going to rake in some big pay-per-view sales. Nowhere near Mayweather. I'm not saying that. I think he is going to be a big star because he does things the right way. He's smart. He's intelligent. He can fight, and he's my favorite fighter, so I'm biased right now. But he's my favorite
The only
fighter,
thing I disagree with, Travis, Pacquiao's electrifying. We haven't seen that from Ward yet. I'm still waiting to see that.
This is true. I mean, Pacquiao did have a couple pretty big knockouts on his streak, but as everybody knows, we don't know how authentic that little knockout streak that he went on was. Not saying anything more than that, but we don't know. And I think Andre Ward, there's never been a lot of talk around him that has anything to do with him cheating, has anything to do with him being a bad person, anything to do with him outside the ring. Andre Ward is just, I want my kids to look up to a guy like him. I think he does things the right way. I think he's a good guy. I think the world will catch on, especially if he keeps winning. He's got to keep winning. I give you that. He's got to keep winning. If a guy like Andre Ward, the way he fights, if he loses, people will forget him for sure. But if he keeps winning and keeps winning, you can't forget that. People can't overlook that, and they won't.
Okay, this is what separates me from you three guys, because you three guys are boxing experts, and I'm just a journalist. But I think all three of you guys are on record picking Andre Ward to beat Kovalev. I've decided I'm going the other way on this. If Ward cannot hurt Sullivan Barrera, I don't think he can hurt Kovalev. I'm not sure he can hurt any top-drawer guy at 175. If Kovalev, based on what I saw last night, if Kovalev has up to 12 rounds to bust him up, I think that's what happens to Andre Ward, even despite Andre Ward's genius as a defensive fighter. And I know all three of you guys are going to tell me I'm full of crap. Eventually, he hands something that puts Ward in trouble, a place that we haven't seen Andre Ward before, and then we're going to find out something about Andre Ward. And Kovalev's a sensational finisher. So, yeah, I think Ward's chin is good. It's great. His defense fantastic. But I doubt if it's good enough, Riz. I think Kovalev KOs Andre Ward. So this is your chance to beat me down today on Easter Sunday. Go ahead, Riz.
You know what? It's a little strange. I think actually, in some ways, yesterday really didn't tell me a whole lot. What it told me is that, okay, Ward is not going to move as much. He's gotten a little older. He's going to stay in a little pocket a little more. But it also told me that he's not an active fighter. I mean, even yesterday we saw him be probably more active than most fights, but he still threw under 40 punches around. And a guy like Kovalev is a lot larger than Barrera. I mean, Kovalev probably walks around heavier. And if I'm going to see height-wise, I think he's got to have a couple inches on him, too. Ward looked all right yesterday. I mean, he's got the couple knockdowns. And, I mean, Barrera was not – I mean, we know he's Cuban, but he's not that standout Cuban amateur. He wasn't one of those kind of guys. In some ways I agree with you, because what happens if Ward takes a shot from Kovalev? I mean, he took a few shots last night, but Barrera's not the puncher that Kovalev is. Barrera doesn't have the chin Kovalev does. Barrera just also doesn't have the kind of crazy psycho mentality that Kovalev does, and you can't teach something like that. So in some ways, I think if anything, I mean, if Ward's going to fight the same way he did yesterday, I think Kovalev has a much better chance than I gave him maybe 6 months ago. Kovalev's getting better. Ward's getting older. Ward might have lost his best years. I think, you know, I think he knows this, and I think other people know this too, that he wants to get one more fight before Kovalev, which would give him three fights this year, which is something he hasn't done in a while. Depending on who he fights, I would like to see that fight before I think we can make a final prediction with him and Kovalev. And Kovalev's probably going to have at least another fight in between. Kovalev's a fairly active guy. I can't imagine him going from January all the way to November without any fights in between. Style-wise, what makes this fight so interesting is that it could be the kryptonite for both fighters. And now, I don't think it's going to be a necessarily entertaining fight. And I think that's why a lot of people are rooting for Kovalev, because guys like Kovalev and Golovkin, we see how good they are, but they're entertaining too. They get the knockouts. And I think a lot of people got sick of the Mayweather-Pacquiao, the end of that era, when all of their fights were decisions. They were all kind of predictable. And even though you appreciate the genius of it, you want some entertainment. I mean, you knew Mayweather was going to outbox everyone he ever fought. You know Ward has the ability to outbox everyone, but Mayweather never really fought anyone at the peak of their career the way Ward is going after Kovalev. And I appreciate that from Ward, where he's actually looking at He went up to this division. I mean, I don't think he can make 168 anymore. He looks physically bigger, but he wants to fight the best. And you got to remember, this is almost the second part of Ward's career. He won the Super 6. But think about the fighters he beat there. He beat Frosch. He beat Abraham, if memory serves me correctly.
Yep.
He beat Kessler in kind of a sloppy affair, but he still got the W, and a lot of people didn't think he was even going to be there. He's still 32, so even though he's kind of gotten older, this is almost like his second form in career, if that makes sense. It's obviously not the same gap, but he couldn't make noise in this division, and beating Kovalev would make him instantly the king of that division, because I think if there's someone who's going to beat him in that division, it's going to be Kovalev, and vice versa. These are the number one, two fighters in that division. We just don't know the order yet.
This is the Ringside Boxing Show from Monterey, California. We are talking to Travis Hartman, Rizwan Zahid, John J. Responti, our expert analysts. They're with us every week. The great Joe Cortez is coming up in just a few minutes, so stay with us for that. I want to talk real quick about the co-feature where Jojo Diaz, who was on this show about 3 weeks ago, beat Jason Velez in what I thought was really a fun and terrific performance. This is a guy I cannot wait to see again. He against an elite guy. I hope he fights one more Velez-type opponent before he makes that jump, because I think he needs that. But, Jojo Diaz has fast hands. He's got nice feet. He's got a good, really good feel about how to optimize ring space to his advantage. He's got some pop in both hands. I think Diaz has some genuine star power. And the great part, John, is there are other featherweights out there, maybe 9 or 10 of them, who can potentially do for Jojo Diaz what Morales and Barrera did for each other, what Castillo and Corrales did for each other, Mickey Ward and Arturo Gatti. To me, this is tantalizing. Whereas, once again, Andre Ward and Kovalev and maybe Adonis Stevenson only have each other to go through before they're completely out of options. After that, the well is completely dry for those guys. Jojo, man, the world is his oyster right now, and I'm really excited about that kid's future. What do you think, John?
Yeah, I agree. I want to say something about Andre Ward real quick, though. The great equalizer about Andre Ward is to me, is his boxing brain. We can never underestimate his boxing brain. He's the smartest fighter I've seen in there since Mayweather. So that he might give up more power to Kovalev, and, you know, he did knock Barrera down. But his brain will bring him to the same level of Kovalev. So that's why I still give him the edge, but right now it could be even closer to 50-50. But you can never underestimate that that man's brain, because he's one of these people that he's so focused that he figures things out as they go along. Yeah, now Jojo Diaz, Dennis, you're right. I mean, he was very impressive because he was so consistent. You know, I'd seen him on tape and everything, but, you know, he goes to the body, bam, bam, with two punches, and then he come up to the head, and his defense was good, and he was exciting, and he's a boyish kid, you know, young kid. He's got some charisma. So I was impressed. The crowd didn't seem as impressed where I was, but I thought he was very solid. Southpaw, Velez, defense is kind of weak, but Jojo was on point with his punches, and his defense is pretty good, and he's got that. Again, you know, I always end up going back to some of these Southern California fighters, and he is a Southern California fighter. He's from El Monte. Reminded me of somebody that I would have loved to see in the Olympic Auditorium, because he likes to punch, you know, and he likes to throw punches, and his defense is good, but he's kind of an action guy. So it made for a very good fight, and it was the most important fight of his career, Dennis, and he brought his A game, and he was pleased. He got headbutted, he got cut a little bit, but you know, I talked to him after the fight, and he was very pleased with his performance. So was his manager. So yeah, it's up and away for Jojo. I'm not quite as sold on how good he is at this point, because Jason Velez's defense is pretty spotty. But he certainly has Jojo certainly has the quickness, the feet, the pedigree of a guy that you can see going places and getting the big fight. So it's going to be, you know, the featherweight division is just incredible right now. So he's going to get some big fights, and then we'll find out. But, yeah, he did a very good job last night. I was certainly impressed.
Travis, give me your take on Jojo last night.
Yeah, I mean, the kid's so talented. And I like his lefty style. I don't know. He just looks so comfortable in that style. And just looks. Some people, like whether it's basketball, football, anything else, they just have that style that looks just so natural for that person. And he's got that. And I like it. And he's definitely an action fighter. He's somebody who who the general public, like you, Dennis, for sure, would love to watch because you like that action pack. You like those guys that come for it, and Diaz brings it. I mean, there's no secret there, you know. Definitely most Mexican fighters do bring it as it is, and he definitely represents that. But he can also fight, so it's the kid's heavily skilled. I think the kid does have a really bright future, and I think you're exactly right, Dennis. I want to see him in there with another Velez type of guy, you know, an experienced guy, but not a guy at that elite level just yet. I don't know if he's there yet. I want to see them take him, bring him up like a future great or future world champion. I think the next step for him would be, you know, another type of match like he just had. So I like his style. I like what he represents. And I'm looking forward to watching his career progress, especially since he's a Ringside Boxing radio show alumnus. So I'm definitely pulling for him, as everybody on this show should be.
This is the Ringside Boxing Show from Monterey, California. Joe Cortez, the great referee, is coming up in just a couple of minutes. Riz, and I'll let you talk about JoJo if you want to. Another fighter I'm crazy about and have been for a long time is Kell Brook, who really didn't fight a top-drawer guy yesterday, but I think this guy is as good as any welterweight in the world, and I think other welterweights are going to continue to avoid him like the plague until there's a fortune on the line, maybe at Wembley Stadium or someplace like that. What's intriguing to me about Kell Brook right now is that he's a 147-pound force of nature who's calling out Golovkin, who's the 160-pound King Kong. If he's serious, I admire the hell out of his guts, if not his career plan. But I don't like his chances to survive a fight with Golovkin. I don't give Khan a real good chance against Canelo. I don't like Khan's chin in that fight. But nobody else seems to be standing in line to fight either Kell Brook or Amir Khan right now for some reason. And it doesn't seem like they're going to fight each other. So if you want to talk about JoJo, go ahead. If you want to talk about Kell Brook a little bit, go ahead. But floor is yours, Riz.
Well, JoJo Diaz, I mean, he was impressive last night. I mean, this was a guy, he was fighting a guy who's, you know, former, kind of that guy who's borderline contender. Always gives a tough fight. Couldn't knock him out, but he came as close as you can. You know, really hurting on several occasions, but man, Velez can take a shot. Jody is also really young. He's still 23 years old. He has power. It's weird. It doesn't seem obvious. He doesn't get a lot of knockouts, but he does have power. I wouldn't rush him into anything just yet, but I think, you know, he has some bad habits, but I think he can get better, but he's kind of ready for the big time, I think, now. He can, you know, he clearly has a lot of skill, great amateur background. I think he's going to do really well in this sport, but I think the issue is we're going to find out, is he going to be an Arturo Gatti who has skill but is more entertaining, or is he going to be kind of a Morales Barrera who knows how to mix into entertainment while still winning? And I think that there's a fine line in between. Kell Brook, you know what? I don't know if he's actually serious about Golovkin. Maybe he is. I think the best thing for him to do is come over stateside again, because when he did that, he had the biggest win of his career against Sean Porter. And, you know, Sean Porter looks like he's going to fight Thurman, and Brook is kind of left in the dark. I understand he wants to fight at home, but the best decision he made was when he came over to the States. And since then, I mean, that was almost 2 years ago now. Here's who he's fought since. JoJo Dan, solid fighter, no one great. Frankie Gavin, same thing. Kevin Bizier, whose only losses were against JoJo Dan on a couple decisions. Maybe I'm a little biased because there's two Canucks who went down against him, but I think Brook I think has the capability of beating Danny has the capability of beating Green for sure. I'd give him a good chance against Thurman. He's already beaten Porter, so I think it makes sense for him to come to that side. I understand he thought he had the leverage by getting the title he could defend at home, but I think he has to come over stateside because we've seen him hurt before, but skill-wise, he's a fantastic athlete. I think he's trouble for anyone in that division. I mean, the Amir Khan fight, it seemed like that was going to happen before, you know, Canelo became an option. That's just a bigger fight. Amir Khan knows that the Kell Brook fight will always be there for him. An all-British, you know, huge fight, that's always going to be there for him. So that's why Khan elected for Canelo. But for Kell Brook, I think he wants to get more leverage, and he'll get that by beating bigger names.
Man, I wanted to get to Planet of the Weird and Adrian Broner this week, but I got Joe Cortez waiting. That's Travis Hartman, Rizwan Zahid, John J. Responti on the Ringside Boxing Show. They are our expert analysts. They're with us every week. Thank you, gentlemen. You guys have a great day. Travis, you have some fun there in Margarita Land with your margaritas.
I'm sure Adrian Broner will do something next week for us to talk about. Don't worry.
Yeah, you're right. All right, guys. We're going to take a quick break. Be right back with Joe Cortez.
Hi, I'm Dennis Taylor, host of the Ringside Boxing Show, where, since 2008, we have been continuously sponsored by Garcia Boxing, the first family of the Sweet Science on California's beautiful Central Coast. Trainers Max and Sam Garcia and ring strategist Dean Familton are regarded among the most knowledgeable in the game. And Kathy Garcia, who manages all Garcia Boxing fighters, is renowned for her integrity and career guidance, having taken two boxers to number one world rankings. Together, they comprise one of the most respected teams in the sport. We thank Garcia Boxing for its continued support of the Ringside Boxing Show. Learn more by calling 831-261-3214 or send them an email at garciaboxing25@aol.com. And if you'd like to become a sponsor of this show, send me an email at contacts@ringsideboxingshow.com.
Put 'em up, put 'em up! Which one of your fights? I fight you both together if you want. I fight you with one paw tied behind my back. I fight you standing on one foot. I fight you with my eyes closed. Oh, pulling an axe on me, eh? Sneaking up on me, eh? Why?
You're listening to the Ringside Boxing Show, the hottest, sweatiest hour on West Coast Radio.
Yes, you are. Thank you, Bubbles. Today's featured guest is a native of New York's Spanish Harlem, where he and his brother Mike became the first ever brother combination to win the National Golden Gloves Boxing Tournament in the same year. He went on to post an 18-1 record as a pro, then embarked on a career as a referee that spanned from 1978 to 2012 and included nearly 900 fights, including close to 200 world title fights, I think. We'll get the exact number from him. He was enshrined into the International Boxing Hall of Fame in 2011 alongside Mike Tyson, Julio Cesar Chavez, Kostya Zou, Nacho Beristain, and Sylvester Stallone. And we are thrilled to welcome the great Joe Cortez for his second appearance on the Ringside Boxing Show. Joe, happy Easter. Welcome back. How are you, sir?
Dennis, happy Easter to you guys. Everything is great here in Las Vegas. Just rolling with the punches.
So, man, Spanish Harlem in the 1950s and 60s must have been a challenging place to grow up as a kid. Was boxing a survival instinct for you and your brother?
Definitely. If it wasn't for boxing, I probably won't be alive today. I mean, back in those days, there were so many gangs in the neighborhood. They had the Red Wings, the Viceroys, the Enchanters, the Dragons. And all those, I had to walk through all those gangs, all the neighborhoods, all those gangs to get to the boys' clubs every day, then walk back home. And that was about a good mile and a half. But I'll tell you that it was just walking through the neighborhood, and I put my brother and I used to put our boxing bags, our boxing gloves hanging outside of our bags just to kind of like, you know, tell them that be careful, don't mess with us, we're fighters. And we never got into any fights with any of the gang members. And then we became Golden Glove champions on numerous occasions. That we were favored with all the gangs. You know, we walked through all the gang neighborhoods and nobody would mess with us. On the contrary, they were all our friends and we never had to get involved with the gangs. That's what I tell kids today, you know, when I go to the schools and to the gyms, I tell these young kids, listen, you know what? When you're with a gang, you're not really a true man. When you're a man, when you're in that ring by yourself, you got no gang members with you, you're by yourself in there, that's a real man. That gives you, so boxing gave us a lot of confidence. A lot of self-esteem, kept us off drugs, you know, it kept us on the right track. So I say anybody that walks into that ring, whether you win or lose, just climb up those three steps up into the ring, you're a champion with that alone.
You know, I came across a bit of information about you this week that really surprised me for some reason. You were a bantamweight.
I was a flyweight when I started out, when I won my first Golden Glove championship. And I was a tall, lanky flyweight, then I became a bantamweight, but I was sparring at the original old Bobby Gleason gym with a great Gaspar Indian Ortega. Gaspar Ortega was a welterweight. who fought 185 professional fights and was never given a shot at the title up until he had like 81 professional fights. In the Griffin game was shot, and that was the only time Gasper got a title fight, but he was one of the top contenders and beating some of the best fighters in the welterweight division back in that era where there was only one sanctioning body, and it was only it was the good fighters. But Gasper used to use me for speed with him, so I was kind of tall. I was 5'9", so he would use me for speed. He was 5'10", and I learned a lot with Gasper Ortega. So when I was fighting in the Golden Gloves with my brother Mike, the fans used to watch my brother and I box. They said, "These guys are pros. These guys don't fight like amateurs."
Huh.
So we were 16, 17, 18 years of age, and people thought we were already professional fighters. But I remember one day Manuel Stewart came up to me and told me, "Hey, Joe, you're like a little skinny Puerto Rican that beat Oscar Germain for the Nationals." I said, "Yeah, I was." He said, "You know what? That's the guy that beat me in that tournament." I said, "Okay." So Manuel Stewart knew that. He said, "Joe, if you beat Oscar Germain for the National Golden Glove Championship," he says, you had to be pretty talented. And I was blessed, you know, with the boxing skills that I had, along with my brother Mike. But it was the great Gasper Ortega who broke us in to the sport and brought us up the right way. And we stayed on the right track for the rest of my life.
Joe, did your brother Mike have a pro career? Was he good?
Yeah, he fought. He had about 30-some-odd professional fights.
Wow.
And he was doing okay, but then at the end, he started losing, I think, five of his last six fights. Then he decided to pack it in as well. But my brother Mike fought a draw with Billy Backus. And Billy Backus is a Hall of Fame champion as well. He was Carmen Basilio's nephew. And my brother fought him in Madison Square Garden. And a lot of fans thought my brother won. But Carmen Basilio was in the corner, so I guess he got the edge. But they gave it a draw. So that's it. Well, every time I see Billy back, he's at the Hall of Fame. I say, "Billy, you remember my brother Mike?" He said, "Joe, I don't even want to talk about it." You know? But Mike was a decent fighter. He was a lightweight.
So here's surprising fact number two that I looked up about you this week, and I want to double check and make sure this is true. You grew up in Spanish Harlem and with the name Cortez, but you didn't become fluent in Spanish until you moved to Puerto Rico as a young man and took a job in the hotel industry. Is that really true?
Well, not really, because put it this way. I polished up a lot more with Spanish in Puerto Rico, but when I was with Gasper Ortega, when Gasper Ortega came up from Mexico back in the mid-50s, I was about 12 years old when I met him, and he's the one that didn't speak English, so he needed an interpreter. So it was me that would always go with Gasper Ortega to all his meetings that he had with his managers and wherever he went for interviews or whatever. So I was the interpreter for him, and every time Gasper Ortega fought a big main event in Madison Square Garden, and when he would get paid, I was always with him to interpret the breakdown of the expenses, and they would always give me $5. They say, "Joe, thanks a lot. Here's $5 for you." So for me back then, $5 was a lot of money, you know, that I got that for interpreting for Gasper Ortega. But I learned Spanish a lot better in Puerto Rico when I was the executive manager of the El Conquistador Hotel, which is a 5-star hotel, sister hotel at the time of the El San Juan Hotel. And then I ended up becoming casino operations manager out of our New York office, my last 7 years or the 15 years I spent with the El San Juan Corporation. But I learned a lot of Spanish there, but then now that I'm with ESPN as a boxing analyst, they use me a lot on the Spanish segment, so I'm able to practice a lot more and be a little bit, I would say, a lot better than I was years ago with my Spanish.
Talking to Joe Cortez, Hall of Famer on the Ringside Boxing Show. You ref from 1978 to 2012, 887 bouts according to BoxRec. I read that your dream as a ref was to work one world title fight. What was the final count all total? How many did you work?
Well, you know, I never really kept track, but you're pretty close to about those numbers.
Okay.
My dream was just to do one. When I started out as an amateur, actually, I started refereeing in 77 in New York in that same year, in 77, when I turned pro. And that was the beginning of my my dream. My dream was to first do a world title fight, and it took me 5 years. It was in 1982 when I refereed Iron Pryor against Miguel Montilla in Atlantic City. And that was my dream. I said, if I can just do one, I'll be the happiest man on this planet. And little that I know, didn't know back then that I would get to the level that I made it to. But I'm just honored that I was given a license to become a referee. And it's been like something I got to pinch myself, because everywhere I go, like so many fans, I still have fans out there that they recognize me. And to me, I feel like, wow, yeah, I can't believe it. I'm just a regular guy. I try to be as humble as I can with everybody. And I'm always out helping out wherever I can, help kids get jobs, help keep kids in school, and try to keep them on the right track. I'm just been blessed because the great Gaspar Ortega broke me in the right way to be a humble person like he is. And I've always tried to give a lot more than what I have received.
So, Joe, what do you remember about the Aaron Pryor Miguel Montilla fight? What's your most vivid memory? Were your pre-fight butterflies huge, first of all?
Well, I was a little nervous because, of course, your first world title fight. I said, "Wow, my dream has come true," you know. But I remember Aaron Pryor. I had to watch out for the safety of the fighter. But Aaron Pryor, you know, was a fighter. I used to call him Hawk Time. Yeah. Every time he come out, Hawk Time, Aaron Pryor. So he would always dash across that ring. I mean, he would fly. And when you with the bell rung, if you didn't get up off your stool quick enough, he was right on top of you. And I knew he would do that. And I was afraid that he could hurt a fighter. And I would tell him in the dressing room, "Aaron, I'm going to be in the middle of that ring. When I'm in the middle of that ring, you don't go flying across me. You're going to stay there. When I see both fighters, you both meet at the center of the ring." And I remember that was one of the main things that I had to keep my eyes on, because he was so quick to jump on you and just start banging away. And I don't want to see fighters get hurt, especially as a referee. I learned at a young age that the most dangerous areas in the ring is in the corners. If a fighter gets trapped in a corner, that's where you got to get tendency of getting hurt seriously. And Aaron Pryor was good at that. He would get you guys, always put that pressure on you, get you up against the ropes or in the corner, and just bang away with all kinds of punches from all different angles. So I was I was on top of my game, but I was a little butterfly, because I knew he can hurt his opponents. And I think I stopped the fight. I think it was in the 11th round or so, around there. But it was great memories.
Joe, you were the third man in the ring for some of the greatest fights that I can remember as a boxing fan. Let me toss a few more memorable matchups that you reffed, and if you've got a story, a memory or two that comes to mind, share those. How about Pernell Whitaker and Julio Cesar Chavez Jr., majority draw in 1993?
Well, it was in junior, it was senior.
I'm sorry, senior, yeah.
It was, that fight took place at the Alamo Dome in Texas. So remember, there was a crowd of 65,000 fans and indoor arena. And that was a great experience. I mean, I had already refereed Chavez prior to that against Greg Haugen in Mexico City. There was 132,000 fans at Stadium Azteca. But refereeing Pernell Whitaker with Chavez, I remember that was a very difficult fight for Chavez, and a lot of fans walked away unhappy with that decision because they called it a draw. A lot of fans felt that Whitaker won the fight, but it was a great experience for me, being in there with two great champions, two Hall of Famers, and I tell you, it was again, as a referee, when you get in there with the great legends like Chavez, Whitaker, Tyson, and just to name a few of the many great champions I've refereed throughout my career, it's just an amazing feeling. And that's why I like to teach referees. I've been working with Kenny Bayless, Tony Weeks, Benji Estevez, Russell Mora, Mark Nelson. Just to name a few of the referees that I've been working with on a regular basis. And I want to make sure that these referees get to enjoy boxing the way I have, but also teach them to watch out for the safety of the fat fighters. Our job, first and foremost, is safety first. And that's what I try to teach the referees. Treat these fighters like if they're your sons. Make sure that they don't take unnecessary punishment. Know when to stop the fight. And when people say, Joe, what is it you look for? And well, you can see a fighter right off the bat. You can see a fight. A fight could be competitive, but then it starts going one way. That's when you got to start paying close attention to the fighter who's on the receiving end of the harder punches, taking the worst of the punishment. A fighter gets knocked down, you have to know already, you know, watch him close. If he gets knocked down the second time, now you got to start going into the corner in between rounds if he beats the count. Go into the corner, see how he's doing. Sometimes you got to call in the ringside doctor. You got to start preparing. You got to sell your call. Make sure that people understand you're there to protect these fighters, but you don't want to fight stop a fight too soon, but neither too late. I'd rather stop at a punch sooner than a punch later. And that's where we see too much of fighters getting hurt. And I'm trying to see if I can change some rules in boxing. And one of the things that I want to try to get out there is fighters are committing a lot of fouls, especially with punches behind the head. And there's a lot of fighters that take punches behind the head, and the referees keep letting them get away with it. And I keep telling the referees, listen, a punch behind the head, when they're in the clinch, and they start, one guy bangs one guy behind the head, a rabbit punch, then the other guy does the same thing. I mean, you know, those are flagrant punches. I mean, it's not an accident. You tell fighters any accidental punches, you know, I give some warnings, but if I think it's intentional, there are no warnings. It's an automatic point deduction. And I guarantee you that you start telling the fighters in the dressing room, that's where the referee takes control. Back in the dressing room, you tell them any punches behind their head, they're going to be automatic point deductions. Because everybody's saying, Joe, what can we do to protect the fighters more today? Because there's a lot of concussions, a lot of fighters, a lot of brain injuries. What can we do to prevent that? I think one of the things we can do is tell them about those punches behind the head. That really has a big effect on a fighter. And if you start telling these fighters, start telling the fighters, if you hit him behind the head, the first time you hit him behind the head, and I feel it's intentional, I'm going to start taking points. I guarantee you, once you take that one point at the beginning of the fight, you're not going to see any more punches behind the head from either side. So we're doing something to prevent, you know, injury to the fighter. At least that's one step on the positive side.
Talking to Joe Cortez on the Ringside Boxing Show. Joe, 2001, Prince Nassim Hamed was undefeated. He was number one on a lot of pound-for-pound lists. You were the third man in the ring when Marco Antonio Barrera just dismantled him, took him apart. Did that surprise you?
You know, it kind of did. It kind of surprised me because Prince Nassim Hamed was very flashy. He brought a lot of showmanship into the ring. He showed a he can punch. He was a devastating puncher. He threw punches from all angles, but he had a very, very awkward style. And I said to myself, you got to be careful with this Barrera, because Barrera is a very well-disciplined, good boxer, puncher, yep, that can surprise Prince Nassim Hamed. And I was not surprised that he beat him, but I was surprised by the way he beat him. I mean, he really took Prince Nassim to school. And I remember one time there was an exchange of blows, and they wrestled themselves to the canvas. And while they were on the canvas, they were still trying to fight each other while on the canvas. I had to grab him. I had to actually jump on top of him and pull him apart. They were still throwing punches at each other while they were on the canvas. You know, it was not even a knockdown. It was like a wrestling and a push, you know. And then in another round, Barrera was so upset with Prince Nassim Hamed that he actually physically grabbed him and pushed his head right into the turnbuckle in the corner, you know. And I had to take a point from Barrera, because that video was supposed to be like comeback. But it was crazy, you know. But they had a lot of hatred towards each other, especially Barrera towards Prince Nassim Hamed, because Prince Nassim Hamed was saying how are you going to destroy Barrera and whatnot. So Barrera was really very, very upset with him. But he took him apart and beat him a good decision. And a couple of times there, I thought he was going to put him away. It was a very, very big night of boxing. It was a very exciting night of boxing.
Joe, what do you remember about Duran and Iran Barkley, 1989? You were the third man in that one.
Yes, yes. I remember they had 3 feet of snow that day going to Atlantic City. I left early from New York to get to Atlantic City. And by the time I got to Atlantic City, there was like that night it was 3 feet of snow. And I remember that when Roberto Duran, at the age of 35, he was the underdog because Iran Barkley was at the top of his game. He had just come back from a knockout over Tommy Hearns. He was devastating. He was really out there. People say, well, he's probably going to knock out Roberto Duran. But you know what? I think Duran that night, fighting at 160 pounds. I mean, I remember when he was a lightweight coming in at 135 when he fought Ken Buchanan when he won his first championship at the old Madison Square Garden on 8th Avenue and 51st Street. And then he got in there with Barkley, and it was a war. Every round was getting better and better and better. And you can see it was back and forth, back and forth. It was real close going into the 11th round when Roberto Duran hit Barkley with a barrage of punches and put him down. And Iran Barkley managed to get up, but it was Duran who was now the aggressive for the 12th round and threw the better combination, better punches at the end. And it was a split decision won by Roberto Duran. And he was on cloud nine, being that he won the lightweight championship, the welterweight championship, and now the middleweight championship of the world. And it was a big surprise in boxing because nobody gave Roberto Duran a chance. And I think he fought one of his better fights at the age of 35. That fight was his best fight towards the end of his career.
3 years later, you had Riddick Bowe, Evander Holyfield. What do you remember about that one?
Wow. They had the trilogy. The second one was the Fan Man. That was my other colleague, Bill Slane, was the referee for that. Uh-huh. I had the honor of being the referee for the first one and the third one. And I remember that fight at Caesar's Palace at the outdoor arena. It was a war. I remember the 10th round when Riddick Bowe hit Holyfield with a punch that Holyfield fell back into the turnbuckle in the corner. And the ropes kept him from going down. But as soon as he bounced off those ropes, he came wailing back at Riddick Bowe. And they were banging. They were swinging at each other. They were throwing punches, all kinds of combinations. They call it the round of the year. Maybe one of the best rounds in boxing history as a heavyweight division.
Yep.
It was a great fight. Then the Fan Man, Riddick Bowe, lost the fight. The only loss that he's had in his whole career was against Holyfield. It was that night. Then they had the third match, the rubber match, where I was a referee again, and Riddick Bowe ended up stopping Evander Holyfield. I think it was in the 8th round. But those were great fights with Holyfield and Riddick Bowe. I'll tell you, sometimes I look back and say, wow, did I referee those fights? It was amazing.
Does Riddick Bowe get his due as a heavyweight?
You know, I think that I don't think he really got it. I mean, he could have fought a couple of more great fights, and I would like to have seen him and other great heavyweights. I don't know if Mike Tyson would have been a good one for Riddick Bowe, but I think Riddick Bowe was already finished by the time Tyson came up. You know, it was a fight that would have been good for the fans. But that fight never took place with Riddick Bowe and Mike Tyson. They both came from the same neighborhood in Brooklyn. And I think Riddick Bowe was an outstanding fighter. His only defeat was against Holyfield in that second fight. And a lot of fans questioned that decision because when the Fan Man came in, I mean, that was a crazy night, Mills Lane being the referee. That the Fan Man comes in with a parachute and a fan on his back in the open outdoor arena. That was crazy. I mean, it was like, then they stopped the fight for about 20 minutes, and Riddick Bowe overtold me, Joe, I would have won that fight if it was such a delay in between, because I was ready to go after Holyfield, finish him off, and look at the break of the 20 minutes threw everything off. So it was just boxing.
1994, George Foreman made the whole world feel a little bit younger. He knocked out Michael Moore. You were the referee for that one. Was that a stunner to you when that happened?
That was a big stunner for me because George Foreman, at the age of 45, I mean, he was world champion 20 years earlier, the first time around. Comes back 20 years later and becomes heavyweight champion again at the age of 45. And is beating one of the toughest fighters out there, Michael Moore. And, you know, George Foreman was getting beat just about every round in that fight. But, you know, you always got to give a fighter a puncher's chance. And being that Foreman was a devastating puncher, I mean, I couldn't believe when Michael Moore kept walking into Foreman's right hand. Instead of moving to his left, he was moving. I'm sorry, instead of moving to his right, he was moving to his left, right into Foreman's power right-hand punch. But I guess Foreman kind of set him up for that because I remember Foreman hit him with the left hook and pushed him over to Foreman's right-hand side. So he pushed Michael Moore with the left hook. So Michael Moore went to the left, and Foreman came with that straight right hand, and down goes Moore on his back. And when I couldn't believe the knockdown came, but it was short, a short right-hand punch. And when Moore goes down, I remember trying to push Foreman to the neutral corner because I'm trying to push a brick wall. He was so stunned himself, he couldn't believe he put this guy down. And I got him to that neutral corner. I picked up the count at 5, 6, 7. When I was at 7, I said, I don't think this guy's going to get up. 8, 9. I waved my hands. 10. And wow, then I looked over and Foreman dropped onto his knees and looked up to the sky like, God, thank you, God. Thank you, Lord. You know, he couldn't believe it. He knocked out Michael Moore, Michael Moore become heavyweight champion at the age of 45. That was a punch that was heard around the world.
Man, as a referee, you were the man during the whole De La Hoya era, too. You had De La Hoya, his win over Julio Cesar Chavez. You had his win over Fernando Vargas, which was a great fight. You had his loss to Mosley. What do you remember about De La Hoya in his heyday?
You know, De La Hoya was a golden boy. That's a proper name for him. A golden boy. You know, he won the Olympics when his mother was sick and she died of cancer while he was away at the Olympics. And he was always a fighter that gave it all he had. Very disciplined during his early part of his career. He really took care of himself very well. And I refereed 6 of his fights. And he always came to fight and gave the fans their money's worth. You know, he was a great boxer, but when he had to slug it out with you, he would slug it out. He was dangerous. You know, he could really hurt fighters when he wanted to. But he was one of the outstanding fighters and made a lot of money in boxing because of his style. He was a crowd pleaser, had great pay-per-view events. And I think that when he fought Chavez in 1996, the first time he fought Chavez, I remember I refereed that fight, and that was the beginning of the passing of the torch of Julio Cesar Chavez, a great legend in boxing, and passing the torch on to a young Oscar De La Hoya, who was surprised the world by cutting Chavez with the hard left jab in the first round by a 2-inch cut over Chavez's eyebrow. And I remember I had to stop the fight on numerous occasions, and I felt that the Chavez was going to get hurt because he was blinded by his own blood. And I called in the ringside doctor, Dr. Flip Bomansky, on numerous occasions during the fight. And then I think it was at the end of the fourth round or fifth round, I felt Chavez was starting to get hit pretty bad with some good punches from Chavez, from De La Hoya. And I just felt like, let me call the doctor in one more time, because during the course of the round, I called time. I wanted the doctor to look at it. It was so much blood. And I knew the cut was a very serious cut. And so I had the doctor, say, Joe, I said, you have to stop it. I kind of felt bad, but in a way I felt good that he didn't get knocked out. I didn't want to see a legend like Julio get knocked out. But that was going to happen if I didn't stop it the way I did. So like I said, my job, first and foremost, is to protect the fighters. And I treated Chavez like he was my own son. I'm going to protect him. I knew what was coming next. So I said, let me stop it now. And, it was one of the great nights of boxing for the boxing fans. A lot of the Mexicans didn't like Oscar De La Hoya winning because he was a Mexican-American and Chavez was a Mexican from Mexico. So they had a Julio Cesar Chavez. The fans were more on his side. They were favoring Chavez. But it was the beginning of Julio Cesar's Chavez ending and the beginning of Golden Boy's great career. That was a big, big fight of his career.
Joe, in what way does a ref begin to notice his age? And when did you know it was time for you to retire?
You know, I refereed for 35 years. Mm-hmm. And I felt that working with Tony Weeks, Kenny Bayless, those two referees here in Vegas, after Mills Lane's end, which is still retired, they retired in their 60s, late 60s. And I said, you know, that's a good age to get out. You know, get out while you're still on top. But I was thinking ahead. I think 10 years ahead, always. Whatever I do in life, I'm always thinking 10 years ahead. I don't wait for the last minute to start making decisions. But I want to be sure that I'm making the right decision. So I started training Kenny Bayless. Richard Steele was training Kenny Bayless. I was training Tony Weeks. Benji Esteves from back east working with these guys. And I said, when I get these referees at the level that I think that they can be the top referees out there, that's going to give – it'd be like a cushion for me to step down. I said, I know I'm not going to be there forever. I don't want to stay out there. And like I've seen some great referees stay around too long. And then what happened, they got pushed out. Before you know it, they were not doing championship fights anymore. They hadn't doing 10-round fights, 6-round fights, 4-round fights. And they were so upset that they were not getting any big championship fights. I used to say, that's not going to happen to me. I'm going to go out while I'm still on top. So I think the last year that I refereed was 2012. And that was 1 year after I got inducted into the International Hall of Fame. I got inducted in my 34th year as a referee. I was still active. I told my wife, Sylvia, you know what? I think I'm going to wait one more year. I'm going to go out because I got my referees already in place. I see the way they're working. They're doing really good. And it's time for me to get ready to step down. And I stepped down, you know, gracefully. And I just felt like I did the right thing. 35 years, I got inducted into a Hall of Fame. I was inducted into the New Jersey Hall of Fame, into the World Boxing Hall of Fame. I told Sylvia, I think it's time for me to get out. You know, I think I did about 6-7 world championship fights that year. I said, let me go out with the big one. I went out with a Canelo Alvarez and Joselito Lopez fight. I announced my retirement that night. And I was happy that I stepped down when I did. I have no regrets. Do I miss it? To some extent, I'm still in the game. I'm in a mix. I do a lot of work with ESPN. I still work with my referees. I'm very much involved with boxing, especially now with ESPN Deportes. And I do a lot of work with them, Spanish and English, but mainly Spanish. So I'm always at the big fights. I'll be at the big fight in 2 weeks with Bradley when he faces Manny Pacquiao for the third time. Then I'll be for the Canelo Alvarez and Amir Khan fight. I'll be at ringside for those fights for ESPN, even though they're Showtime events and HBO events, but we cover before the fight and after the fight for ESPN. So it's a lot of fun. I really enjoy it.
Man, I've got 50 more questions for you, and we're out of time. Joe Cortez is one of the all-time greats in boxing history, International Boxing Hall of Famer, still making huge contributions to the sport, works for spinal cord research in honor of his daughter who was injured in an automobile accident a few years back. Joe, always a great pleasure. Hope it was fun for you today because it certainly was for the rest of us. Thank you once again for joining us on the Ringside Boxing Show. It's just a real fun time.
Well, it's been a pleasure to be on your show with you. You got to have a great show. Wish you the best. And all the fans out there listening, wish you all a very happy Easter. Enjoy with your loved ones. And remember one thing. Keep your guards out at all times. Protect yourself at all times because you never know. If you drop those guards, you're going to get hurt. So in anything you do in life, keep those guards up and you'll go forward. And always think positive, and thank God for all your blessings.
He's fair, but he's firm. Joe Cortez on the Ringside Boxing Show. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, buddy. Bye-bye, Dennis. Bye.
That'll do it for today's Ringside Boxing Show. Thanks one more time to our featured guest, Joe Cortez. Thanks, as always, to our outstanding expert analysts, Travis Hartman, Rizwan Zahid, John J. Responti. If you missed any part of today's show, it'll be replayed at 8 p.m. Pacific, Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, right here at RadioMonterey.com, and we will also have it posted by tonight at RingsideBoxingShow.com. Thanks for being with us today, Ringside Nation. We'll see you next Sunday on the Ringside Boxing Show.